So Rhyme Tovim, welcome everybody. Hope everybody's doing well, having a nice week, enjoying the beautiful weather we're having on the East Coast, wherever you might live. I think it's all through the East Coast. Really beautiful fall weather, beautiful colors. And anyways, it's a pleasure to welcome you all. As Shuli just alluded to, and you'll be all wishing her mazel tov because Baruch Hashem, her son is getting married in a week and a half. So next Thursday, we're going to postpone that class. There'll be no class next Thursday. Of course, we'll make it up at the end. We'll just extend the sessions for an extra week. So I will send that up by email, but just to let you know, there will be no class next Thursday. Tonight at 8:30 or 3:30 a.m. in Israel, for those who can't sleep, Shoshana Schechter will be giving the Parshat HaShavua. She's the Dean of Jewish Studies at Stern College. And I don't know if that's her exact title, but it's along those lines. And then tomorrow morning, I'll be giving the class on the Siddur, a close look at the Siddur at 9:30, a Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15 on Sunday, et cetera, a regular schedule. Okay, with that, Shuli, bevakasha, we look forward to your class on the Masoretz, I believe, this week.
Okay. So here we go, everybody. Hold on tight, because this week we have a lot of sources, a lot of different things to talk about. So let's get started. So what we're going to talk about this week, last week we did a lot on the Crusades and the Mamluks. We're actually going to go a little bit backwards in time because I wanted you to have sort of the larger secular background. But now we're going to focus in the next classes on particular places and movements. So what we're going to do today is we are going to go to a place that is exceedingly important in Jewish history, in Jewish tradition, and yet has very little physical remains. And we're going to see why that is. It's because there are earthquakes that happen there frequently. And that, of course, is Tveria. Tveria is a place that has incredible importance as the home of the Masorah, as we're going to see on a number of different levels, both the Masorah as in the continuation of the oral law of Torah Shebaal Peh, as well as the more technical Masorah or Masorah, right? The way we write and annotate our texts. And that's the great picture that we have here. A few years ago, the city of Tveria, which despite its glorious history is presently rather dysfunctional, but what they tried to do to kind of jazz the place up a little bit is by the Kinneret, by the water, they made a street that was like a pedestrian promenade with all kinds of sculptures related to the history of Tveria. And this was one of my favorite ones. I'll tell you the other one that I love. I didn't bring a picture of it, but it's very similar. What you can see is these characters who are schlepping all sorts of burdens. And the burdens, of course, are the nikudot, right? Are the vowels, because the vowels, the way they're written, not their pronunciation, but the way they're written, originate with a group called the Masoretes in Tveria. And we're going to talk about them. They're not the ones who come up with the tunes and the sounds that we use, right? And we're not only talking about vowels, we're also talking about the ta'amim, right? The annotations, the notes in the text that tell you how to lane, how to read the Torah. They don't come up with the sounds, but they are the ones who write them down and preserve them for later history. So I always say whenever I see this, if you learned how to read Hebrew, it's thanks to the Masoretes, because without them, it would really be very difficult. The other sculpture that they have there, which the first time I saw it, I was like very dumbfounded. I didn't understand what it was. And I was with my kids and one of them explained it to me. It looks almost like Braille on the sidewalk. You look down, you see these dots on the sidewalk and you're like, is it writing something in Braille? No, it's also the nikudot, right? The vowels. So that's one of the things that Tveria is famous for. And we're going to see other things as well. It really has a rich intellectual history, a very poor archaeological presence, although that's being rectified a little bit now. So we're going to see that as we go along. And we're basically talking about Tveria, not pre-Crusader, okay? Unlike the other places we mentioned last week, Tveria does not, it thrives for a very short time under the Crusaders. Once the Crusaders are defeated there by Salah ad-Din, Tveria falls into a decline. In fact, it becomes moribund for centuries upon centuries. So we're really talking about the time before that. And let's take a look at our timeline to understand what's going on. So lots and lots of centuries going on here, right? This is a long history. On the other hand, Tiberia is not one of the oldest cities, right? It's not a biblical or a pre-biblical city. We're not talking about Hebron or Akko or Ashkelon, which go back much further. Tiberia is only founded in Second Temple times, okay? Why we'll get to, okay? Founded by Herod's son, one of Herod's many sons, Herod Antipas, okay? It goes through the Great Revolt. We have a famous story that we're going to read about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who makes it possible for people to live in the city, because up until then, people didn't want to move there because they thought it was impure. And then what's important for us is the moment where the Sanhedrin, which we're going to see, has moved up to the north, right, much before our period, goes to Tiberia. And Tiberia is the last stop of the Sanhedrin, and it's the last stop for many centuries. Okay, there's debate among scholars when exactly the Nisi'ut and the Sanhedrin comes to a close, but certainly in terms of rabbinic leadership, teaching, yeshiva, Tiberia remains the center for a very long time. Okay, for the next 7-8 centuries. The Jerusalem Talmud, despite its name, is completed in Tiberia. Okay, even though the Patriarchate, the Nisiut, is abolished in Byzantine times, Jewish leadership remains in Tiberia. And even, by the way, once Jerusalem is resettled because the Muslims allow the Jews to come back, Jews come back to Jerusalem, but Tiberia remains an important place. Now, a big jump in the kind of socioeconomic, political power of Tiberia happens with the Muslim conquest. Okay, 7th century, this is earlier than what we talked about last week. The Muslims conquer, obviously, not only Tiberia, all of the land of Israel, much of the Near East, and they have two capitals we're going to see in the land of Israel, one in Ramleh for the southern and central part of Israel, and the other one in Tiberia for the capital of their Jordan district. Okay? And once you make something a capital, obviously that's a great opportunity for trade, for administration, right? It means the city is going to grow. Okay? Our period that we are really going to be talking about, 7th to the 10th century, the Masoretes, the Paitanim, are active in Tiberia. Who they are, we'll get to, don't worry. Okay? With a very significant, but something that is overcome, but a very significant blip, which is a huge earthquake in 749, written about all over the place, destroys much of the land of Israel, particularly the Jordan Valley, but Tiberia is rebuilt. The Jewish community comes back. The Aleppo Codex, one of the most important texts, ancient texts of Tanakh, is written in Tiberia. Rav Sadia Gaon, who we're going to talk about more next time, passes through Tiberia on his way from Egypt to Babylonia. Another earthquake. Then we have Crusader Tiberia. And then essentially Saladin, 1187, conquers Tiberia, destroys it, and it goes into a very deep slumber until the Ottoman period. Okay, so that's already going to be later. We're going to come back to Tiberia towards the end, I think the second to last class, when we talk about Dona Gracia and the possibility of an autonomous state with its head in Tiberia. Okay, but that's going to be for much later on in the course. So that's just to give us a little bit of an overview. But let's go back. Okay. As we know, and I apologize, if you have the source sheet in front of you, you have the wrong source here. I made a mistake and I corrected it this morning, but it was too late. So don't look at the source sheet for that. You can look at it for everything else. Just look over here. Okay. We know that when Jerusalem is destroyed and the temple is destroyed, the Sanhedrin moves. And we have this very famous list of places that the Sanhedrin moves in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah. People are doing Daf Yomi. It's going to be coming up in a few weeks. Okay. What are the stations of the Sanhedrin? So the Sanhedrin was exiled. And it's actually a very interesting context, this Gemara. It's in the context of talking about the Shekhinah, God's presence, being exiled from the Temple Mount. And then it continues and says, just like God's presence was exiled, the Sanhedrin was exiled, right? Fascinating comparison, or juxtaposition, really. So where's the Sanhedrin exiled? So we have a few inside Jerusalem exiles, the same thing with the Shekhinah, by the way, from the Chamber of Hewn Stone to the Chanut, from the Chanut to Jerusalem, right? From the Temple Mount through to the larger Jerusalem. But what's important for us is the continuation from Jerusalem to Yavne, right? We know Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, people who came to the course we did on the Tanaim, right? Moving to Yavne and then moving to the north. And then we have a lot of back and forth and back and forth. Usha to Yavne, Yavne to Usha, Usha to Shfaram, Shfaram to Beit Sha'arim. You can see it all in the map in front of you. Beit Sha'arim to Tzipori, right? That's the time of Rebbe, of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who lives in both those places. And from Tzipori to Tveria. And Tveria, Amukahi Mikulam. Tiberias is lower than all of them, which is a great statement, right? What does that mean? Hey, it means two things, at least, right? On a physical level, Tveria is lower than all of these other places, okay? If you've ever been to Tveria in the summer, I do not recommend it. Hey, it's very, very hot because it's very low down. You're down in the Jordan Valley. You're below sea level. And it's lower than Tzipori and Shfaram and et cetera, et cetera. But it's also deeper, amuka, right? Amok in a spiritual sense, in a historical sense. We stay there longer. We dig in our roots there longer. And it becomes a place that is so important that, like I said, even when Jews are allowed to return to Jerusalem, they still keep their base and their capital for many, many years in Tveria. Now, just as a little bit of a side note, right, because Jews essentially leave the area of Jerusalem and Judea, first with the destruction of the temple, second with the Bar Kokhba revolt, right, and that's when things really fall apart and people move to the Galil and the Golan. One of the fascinating phenomena which happens mostly in the Middle Ages is that the Jews move, but the holy places move too. You say, how do places move? Well, okay, you have traditions about places. And the traditions about places that when Jews lived near Jerusalem in the center and Jericho and Jordan were in those places. But once everybody moved to the north and they're not familiar with Beit El or Yericho or the southern parts of the Yarden, they actually move those places. They take them with them, right? So, for example, the story of Yaakov, right? The story of Jacob. He escapes. He runs away from his brother who's after him. He runs from Beersheba. He spends the night in Beit El, right? He has his famous dream with the ladder, angels going up and down, and then he continues on, right? Now, we know where Beit El is. Beit El is slightly north of Jerusalem. But the Jews who lived in the north were not really thinking about Beit El north of Jerusalem because they weren't getting to there. So, instead, they moved Beit El, and not just the Jews, by the way, the Christians too, the Crusaders believed this as well. They moved Beit El to where? To Tzfat. And if you've ever gone to Tzfat, you know that there is, among the many, many synagogues there are there, there is this one here on the right, the Beit Knesset Shem Va'Ever. Shem and Ever, you know, remember them? They had their yeshiva that Yaakov stays and learns in according to the Midrash. Did you know that it was in Tzfat? Right? Nice place to go, right? Good fresh air. Go and buy some candles from the candle factory. They move that to Tzfat, right? Not only that, places that are clearly in the south, right? Yoshua crosses the Yarden near Yericho, but the Jews of the Galil move it to a place much closer to the Kinneret. This site on the left here, this is a fascinating picture. It's an old picture from, I don't know, late 19th century. As we know, the Kinneret grows and shrinks depending on how much rain. And this is a period when there clearly was a lot of drought. And these pillars were exposed that had been underwater. And it seems that this is a place that is written about in the 16th century by Rav Yitzchak Luria. Well, he doesn't write about it, but his student, Rav Chaim Vital, right, the Ari student, writes about how there's a place in the Kinneret where you go with a boat and there are pillars there. And nearby is where the well of Miriam, the Be'er Miriam, is buried. Okay, remember when they cross into the land of Israel? No more Be'er Miriam, actually already in the desert, no more Well of Miriam. And the legend is that it gets buried inside the Kinneret. Miriam wasn't there. They weren't in the Kinneret. Doesn't matter. We're moving all things up north and all sorts of stories. We're going to see the Shimshon stories. A lot of things get moved to the north. So it's fascinating. And this phenomenon, as we're going to see when we talk about Tzfat, continues by saying, yes, of course, the Messiah is going to come to Jerusalem, but first he's going to come in the Galil. Okay, first he's going to come to Tzfat, he's going to come to the Banyas, he's going to come to places in the Galil, because that's where Jews lived. Okay, so just another very short digression before we come back to Tveria and around Tveria. In the excavations that have been happening all over in the last, I don't know, 50 years, 60 years, we've been finding all kinds of unbelievable synagogues, each one different from the last, but in the last 10, 15 years, there have been two synagogues that have been excavated right near Tveria that have been shown us that we can never say, oh, we know everything there is to know about synagogue art and synagogue architecture. Because even though we have mosaics, right, we have lots of mosaics in Tzipori and Beit Alpha and Hamat, they follow a similar pattern. They have a picture of the zodiac. They have a picture of the binding of Isaac, of the Akedah. They have a picture of the temple. These two synagogues, Wadi Hammam, and I'll show you Chukok in a minute, right above the Kinneret, right above a little bit north of Tveria, have pictures that are in no other synagogue till now. So, for example, the picture on the right is either, and we only have fragments, right? The whole thing didn't survive. These are builders. What are the builders? Well, the builders could be from last week's Parsha. They could be building the Tower of Babel, or they could be builders who are building the temple. We don't really know, but we have no similar picture from any other synagogue mosaic that looks like that. Even more interesting, because we have it in both places, look at the picture on the left here. Somebody very large, right? Because we can only see his knees and his feet, is beating up some other average-sized people, right? Who are these average-sized people? It seems likely that they are the Plishtim, the Philistines, and this is Samson. This is Shimshon. It's not David and Goliath, because David and Goliath doesn't beat up anybody, but Shimshon definitely does. And if you go to the other synagogue, to Chukok, which is right nearby, here's another picture, very different style, of Shimshon carrying the gates of Aza on his shoulders. Remember that story? He goes to a prostitute and then he gets locked in and he has to get out. He has to escape. So he just rips the gates off and he carries them on his shoulder. Why these Shimshon stories, right? It's fascinating. We don't have it in any other synagogue. Maybe the people of the Galil felt an affinity to Shimshon. Maybe they thought the stories were taking place there. We don't know. But it's showing us that these Galileans are very creative and perhaps are willing to show things that maybe in other places they were more conservative and they didn't want to show. Hey, just take a look at the other one over here on the left. This is just a great one. This is a picture of the story of Yonah, except here Yonah is not being swallowed by one fish. He's being swallowed by a fish that's swallowed by a fish that's swallowed by another fish, right? They're fabulous, these pictures. So this is just to give us a little bit of a sense of what's going on in the Galil. But let's go back to our Tveria story. We said Tveria is only built in the late Second Temple period. Before there was Tveria, there are earlier places. One of them is called Reket. The other one, the more famous one, is called Hamat, right? And as you can see from the name, Hamat, Ham, heat, right? And if you've gone to Tveria anytime in the last, I don't know, 500 years, right, you've seen the hot springs of Tveria. In fact, today there's a spa right by the hot springs. There's also an archaeological site. Hot springs were a very big deal in the old days and also relatively recently, right? They were used for healing. This was a natural source of, you know, geothermal energy. So you didn't have to heat anything up. So they were used for bathhouses. It was a very attractive thing, a hot spring. And so a town grew up around it, slightly south of what we call Tveria today. When Tveria is built, Hamat and Tveria are two separate places. Eventually, the Gemara tells us, they grow and become one city. But the original city is Hamat, okay? And the hot springs are still there. And we have a fascinating discussion in the Gemara in Shabbat, right? Talking about people being tricky, people being people, let's put it that way, right? The halacha is that you cannot warm up water to bathe or for anything on Shabbat, right? You can't light a fire, you can't heat water. But what if the water is heated already, right? What does this mean? How is this water heated? So the Gemara has a discussion. Is it actually fire that's in the center of the earth? Is it the fires of hell, right? That's less interesting to me now than the discussion here, right? Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi said, Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi said in the name of Bar Kapara, initially people would bathe on Shabbos in hot water that was heated before Shabbat. The bathhouse attendants began to heat water on Shabbat and say it was heated before Shabbat. Everybody wants to make it, you know, to trick people. So they would say, oh, it was heated before, but really they would heat it on the day of Shabbat. So obviously we don't want that. Therefore, the sages prohibited bathing in hot water and permitted sweating, right? You could go in the shvitz, right? You just go and your pores would open. They would still bathe in hot water and say, we are sweating. That is why we entered the bathhouse. Therefore, the sages prohibited sweating and permitted bathing in the hot springs of Tveria, in the Chamei Tveria. People would still bathe in hot water heated by fire and say we bathed in the hot springs of Tveria, right? I'm sure not all people, but there are always people who are looking around to find a way out of the halacha. And the hot springs was the way that people managed to do that. So they prohibited even the hot springs of Tveria. But this was an attraction. And the most famous person that we know about from the town of Chamat is Rabbi Meir. Hey, Rabbi Meir, Tana, fourth generation. And we know that he's up north, obviously. This is the post-Bar Kokhba generation. And we have a story about him, very famous story, about him teaching Torah in the synagogue in Chamat on Friday nights. Now, we actually have a synagogue in Chamat. The mosaics that we have from it are post-Rabbi Meir, a little bit after his time. But it's very likely it is an earlier synagogue underneath that this is the one that we're talking about. And actually, it's right below the grave that we talk about as Rabbi Meir's grave. Isn't it? That's a different question, right? But we have this beautiful synagogue with fabulous mosaics. You can see a piece of it here with the images from the temple, the zodiac. Hey, and we also have this very famous story. I won't read the whole story, but you have it in front of you. It's a story that a lot of people will know. Rabbi Meir would teach Torah on Friday nights in the synagogue in Chamat, and a woman would come and listen. This, by the way, is one of the proofs that we have that women did come to the synagogue. Right? We don't always hear about that. But she would stay until the end, and by the time she got home, the candles had burned down. Her husband was very annoyed with her, right? There's no light. The food is cold. And he doesn't want to hear that she went to a shir. He wants her home on Friday night for dinner. And he's so angry at her, he says, I'm not going to let you come in until you go spit in the face of the person who was lecturing. She doesn't know what to do. She goes, she talks to her friends, she sees Rabbi Meir, and he kind of figures out what's going on, and he pretends he has an ailment in his eye. He says, spit in my eye so that, you know, it'll heal what's in my eye. Spit in my eye seven times and then go tell your husband that you spit in his eye seven times. And he says, why do I do this? To make peace between husband and wife, right? Fascinating story. And that's Rabbi Meir. But now let's get to Tveria itself. Okay, so it's founded, like we said, by Herod's son. Why does he need a new town, right? It's not like we don't have enough cities in the land of Israel in Second Temple times. He wants one on the Kinneret, right? Up until this point, around the Kinneret, Jewish communities are basically villages, right? Fishing villages. And, you know, agricultural villages. We hear about this from stories in the New Testament, Jesus and his disciples in these little towns around the Kinneret. But Herod wants something bigger. He wants a trade hub because there's a lot of fishing on the Kinneret. There's boats that go back and forth, major roads. And he, like his father, is thinking how to maximize the economic potential. And so he decides to build a real city. Right? Now he builds a city, and it very quickly becomes a very grand Roman city, much of which was essentially erased for centuries upon centuries because of these multiple earthquakes. Right? The everything was just covered up. There wasn't so much interest or budget or whatever for excavations, but recently, there were excavations in the 70s, wasn't no follow through, and things were covered up again. And recently, in the last 10 years, 15 years, they've been doing amazing excavations. All of what you're seeing here is the Roman city, which is in the southern part of the city of Tveria today, right? And for those people who are familiar with driving in, right, when you drive in on 90 from the south, and you first come into Tveria, first you pass the grave of Rabbi Meir Balanes, like we mentioned. And then as you're heading to the main drag where the hotels and everything else is, this is an archaeological park on your left, which is now really being developed. And it's amazing, right? Now, the city changes and it moves. It starts out in the south. The Crusaders move it to the north. And that's why there are archaeological pieces in various parts. But this is the core of the Roman city. And what you can see here in the picture, it's a great picture, right? You have these two pillars, one on either side, and the entryway to the Cardo, right? To the main north-south street of the city. Okay, we're going to see a source in a minute that talks about the gate to the city. And this is the gate to the city, right? A little further north, if you keep walking along the Cardo, you'll come to this incredible theater, right? Take a look at this really big, beautiful theater telling you this is a first-class Roman city. What about the time period we're talking about? Don't worry, we'll get there. Okay. But meanwhile, so this is a sketch of what the Roman city may have looked like. We have a lot of sources about Tveria. If you learn Gemara, you will find that Tveria just gets mentioned incidentally, right? Not telling stories specifically about Tveria, but just mentioned incidentally in many, many places because it's such an important place. So I brought these sources in Hebrew only. I apologize, but we'll translate. I didn't have them in English. Okay. First, what I mentioned before, this story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which is various versions of it are told in the different Midrashim. I brought you the version in the Gemara and the Yerushalmi Shvi'it. Okay? If you remember, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, third generation Tana, second century of the Common Era, goes into hiding with the Romans, right? The Romans have a price on his head. He goes into hiding in a cave with his son. They study, they learn for 12 years. Finally, they hear the Roman emperor has died. They come out everywhere they look. They're so holy. Everywhere they look, they burn things up. A voice comes out and says, go back to your cave. Go back for another year. And then they come out and their skin is in very bad shape. They've been in a cave, no sun, right? Covered in dirt. And what does Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai do? He goes and he bathes in these baths of Tveria, right? Kishara, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Shinugu Advarim, Amar Nereid, Vinitrachais, Bemerchatzaot, Elishal Tveria. Things calm down. He said, let me go and bathe in the baths of Tveria, right? And he's healed. His skin is healed. So he says, I better do something good for the people of Tveria. Huamar, Tzrichim Anulaso, Takana, Kamoshasu Avotenu, right? We have to do something good for the city like our ancestors did. Huamar, Nitaher Tveria. Because what was the problem with Tveria? Remember, we have Hamat. On the outskirts of Hamat, a little bit north of it, like on the outskirts of any city, is the cemetery of Hamat. And Tveria was built right next door to Hamat. So it wasn't clear where was the cemetery, where were the graves. It wasn't marked carefully. And so people were reluctant to move there because they didn't want to become impure. So what does he do? He does a nice trick. Haya lokeach turmusim. Okay, turmusim are lupines. People eat the seeds of them. They have beautiful flowers. But in this story, it seems that they are fertilized very much by dead bodies, right? So he planted these lupines, and there the lupines would grow wherever there was a dead body. And that's how he knew where you shouldn't live and where you should live. And that's a fascinating story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And the other story, which I'm just going to tell you briefly, is about, and this is just one of those, you know, by the way stories, right? Rabbi Yana, Rabbi Yochanan, Shayu Yoshvim, Al Pailei Shel Tveria. They were sitting by the gates of Tveria. And then they have this encounter with these astrologers, and it turns out that basically the astrologers think that they know the future, and the rabbis tell them, no, for Jews, there's no such thing as astrology. It's how we behave. But it's a by the way telling us of people, of rabbis hanging out in Tveria. Now, according to the Gemara, as we're going to see here, the Gemara in Brachot, hey, there are 13 synagogues in Tveria. So far, we have not found even really one. Hey, meaning, why do I say even really one? Because if you go to the center of Tveria, right by the Leonardo Tveria Hotel, you will see a nice little archaeological park with a big sign that says, this is the Beit Knesset of ancient Tveria. Well, if the sign says it, it must be true, right? No, we don't really know that. But it is an ancient building. Perhaps this is one of the synagogues of Tveria. We really don't know. And again, we have to do more excavations. They have found this large basilica-shaped building in these new excavations, as the picture you have here on the right, which some people very cautiously suggest might have been the building of the Sanhedrin. We have no proof, right? There's no, you know, scratching in the dirt saying Rabbi Yochanan was here, right? But who knows, perhaps. But just take a look at this very interesting Gemara here, by the way, that tells us about these 13 synagogues. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, right, two important Amoraim in Tveria, despite the fact that they had 13 synagogues in Tveria, would only pray between the pillars of where they studied, right? They didn't want to pray in the synagogue. They want to pray in the study hall, in the Beit Midrash, right? Conflict between the synagogue and the study hall, the rabbis and the people. That's a whole other story in and of itself. Now, because the Sanhedrin moves to Tveria and stays there, okay, Tveria becomes known as the home of the oral law. Right? This is the place where the oral law is developed. This is the place where ultimately the Jerusalem Talmud is put together. the great rabbis of the later generations are here. And because of that, you have some fascinating graves in Tveria, which maybe they're right, maybe they're not. But the point is that people felt that this was the place where they should be. So one of the places that's very iffy is the grave of Rabbi Akiva. That's the picture you see here on the left. Rabbi Akiva, we know, died a martyr's death at the hands of the Romans, probably in Caesarea. Whether he was buried at all is a question, right? Because he was probably just tortured and there wasn't much left of his body. We have many traditions about where Rabbi Akiva is buried. But Rabbi Akiva has to be in Tveria because Tveria is where the Torah is being taught and studied. So, of course, Rabbi Akiva, the ultimate teacher, is going to be in Tveria. Similarly, we have the grave of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in Tveria, right? He was nowhere near Tveria. He was in Yavne. He was in the south, but we put him there, okay? One of the graves that's a little bit more, a lot more reliable is the grave of the Rambam. Okay, Maimonides, and that's what you see here on the right. But that's a fascinating story in and of itself, meaning the Rambam dies in 1135. By that point, Tveria is not in such good shape anymore. Tveria is not such an important city anymore. And yet his body is brought here. Did I say that right? Is it 1145? Rabbi Kalman, am I saying the date correctly? Now I'm doubting myself. I'm going to ask you to check that. But in any case, Tveria is not an important city at this point. And he's brought here in any case. 1204, thank you. Much better. Okay.
He was born in 1135.
Right. I knew I had something wrong there. Okay. Right. So 1204 makes much more sense because by that point, the city has been destroyed by Saladin. And yet, according to tradition, his body is brought here. He's buried here, even though there's no more Jewish community here. Okay. Why? Because of the Masorah. Now, why do I say it's a more reliable grave? Because we hear about his grandson, Rabbi David, who is also brought to be buried in Tveria. And he, and this is only two generations later, writes about his grandfather being in Tveria. So, but this idea that this is the place where the Masorah is, and this is where people who are so important to the Masorah have to be buried, that's a very important idea. So let's get to our time period. Okay, we're only halfway through. So here's the Muslim conquest, right? The Muslims conquer early 7th century, incredible, incredible campaign where they really sweep through, come out from Arabia and sweep through so many countries and conquer so much in really two decades. But for our purposes, what's important is their conquest of the land of Israel and putting it into the context of the larger Muslim empire. And what the Muslims do is they create various districts and they rule those districts. Now, the main district is the southern one, right? And take a look down here, okay? Because, of course, for them, Jerusalem is important, right? And that's where they're going to build the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa. It's not the most important city, right? Mecca and Medina are more important, but they still have a connection to Jerusalem, and they make their district of Palestine, right? The capital is a new city, the only city that's built by the Muslims in the land of Israel, by the way, and that's Ramla, okay? Not Ramallah, Ramla, like Lod and Ramla. They create a new city from scratch, and that's the capital in the center, okay? A lot of fascinating history there. But then they want another capital for the north, right? For the Jordan district, Al-Urdan, okay? Connected much more closely to Damascus, which eventually becomes the capital. And that, for that, they choose Tveria. And Tveria is the capital there, okay? Now, that is very significant because what that means is when you are a capital of a district, trade is going to come through, jobs are going to come through, right? A lot of administration, you have trade routes, you have connections to the leadership in the area of Syria. So this is a jump for Tveria. Now the Muslims, as we're going to see in one second, are way more tolerant than the Christians, and they allow the Christians to stay, they allow the Jews to stay. The Muslims have a policy whereby you have people who are called dhimmi. Right? Dhimmi literally means the protected people in Arabic. And the protected people are the people of the book, right? People who have a holy book, i.e. Tanakh or the New Testament. Okay? Everybody in the Muslim world, right? When Muhammad goes out on his jihad to conquer and make things part of the Muslim empire, it's not just a political conquest. It's a religious conquest. You come to a place, you are in what is called in Arabic, Dar al-Kharb, the house of the sword, meaning you have a choice, the sword or Islam. And that's one of the reasons why Islam spreads so quickly, because most people make the choice to go with Islam and not with the sword. But Jews and Christians and Zoroastrians have protected status. They do not have to convert. They can, but they do not have to. They are not forced to. They have freedom of religion. In return, they have to follow many, many, many rules, which essentially make them second-class citizens, but protected second-class citizens. And one of the very important ones is a particular tax, a poll tax that they have to pay. But then there's this whole list. Now, we have this letter, which was written to the Christians, but we assume it was more or less the same throughout the Muslim world. And obviously, every ruler did his own thing, right? But the rules, as you can see, right, this is called, usually it's called the Pact of Omar. Whether it was really written by Omar or not is less important. This is really what was done, right? The idea is you cannot build new churches or new synagogues, okay? You cannot have a church or a synagogue that's higher than a mosque. You cannot convert people, okay? You have to be very respectful. You cannot look like Muslims. You can't even teach the Quran, which you would think, well, why not? Because it's disrespectful, okay? You have to have a lower voice. You have to not be buried nearby. You have to have lower houses, right? You are very clearly a second-class citizen. However, you're allowed to stay alive and you're allowed to practice your religion. And in general, up until the modern period, Jews had not particularly high status in many Muslim countries, but they were protected, which is not the case in the Christian world. And we talked about the Crusaders last week and the massacre of Jews and Muslims. In general, Jews had it better in the Muslim world than in the Christian world. They were not forced to convert and they were not persecuted. Now, what does Muslim Tveria look like? That's a great question. I just told you it was thriving. It was great. Jewish communities, two Jewish communities. In fact, we hear about the community of the Vatikim, right? The old timers from the land of Israel, and a community of the Olim Chadashim, of the new immigrants from Babylonia. But archaeologically, very little as of yet. We may find more. Who knows, right? So for example, on the left here, you have a Roman bathhouse. But the Roman bathhouse stayed in use still in the Muslim period. Okay? Very close to the bathhouse is in fact this building here with the cover over it. You have some large building, which may be a marketplace. It may be one of the great mosques we hear about. We don't have enough for us to say. Okay? Unfortunately, we hear about places in literature, but we haven't found them yet in archaeology. And if we could have found more, right? And then along comes the earthquake. Now, earthquakes are a terrible plague in this region. When we get to the spot, we're going to talk about earthquakes as well. But one of the greatest earthquakes, and one that we know about because everybody writes about it, Jews write about it, Christians, Muslims, everybody writes about it, and we also see it in archaeology, is the earthquake of 749. Hey, what do I mean we see it in archaeology? So if you look at these pictures here, the large picture on the left is from Beit Shan. The smaller picture on the right is from a site called Susita on the eastern side of the Kinneret. And what you can notice, particularly in the one from Susita, is particularly nice. All the pillars have fallen in the same direction, meaning they all fell at the same time. Ploop, right? There's an earthquake. They all fell down. Okay? And Beit Shaan is completely destroyed. Many cities in the land of Israel, as well as smaller places, are destroyed by the earthquake. It's a very, very traumatic thing. And that's why everybody writes about it. One, we have P.U. Tim about it. One of the references that we have, here we have from the Cairo Gniza, okay, Ubechaf Gimel Bishvat, the 23rd day of the month of Shvat, Tzom Le'eretz Yisrael, there's a fast day in the land of Israel, Yikru'uhu Tzom HaRash, it's the fast of the earthquake, Mishum She'eretz Yisrael Ra'asha V'naflu Mimena Harbei Arim Mimetu Tachat HaCharavot Chachamim, right, because there was a terrible earthquake, many cities were destroyed, many great scholars were killed, V'yesh Lo B'mikra'ot Remez B'za'am Titz'ad Aretz, right, they bring a pasuk from Sefer Ovadia, and of course then they play with with the letters Za'am and the gematria of Za'am, I didn't do the math, but is basically the amount of time between when the temple is destroyed and when the earthquake happens. We also have Piyutim that talk about this earthquake as Ra'ash HaShvi'it, Shvi'it, the seventh, not the seventh earthquake, but it's an earthquake that happens in the Shemitah year. Okay, we're in the Shemitah year right now. 749 was also 748, 49 was also a Shemitah year. So the earthquake has a great impact, and unfortunately destroys a lot of what we would have hoped to find from the archaeology. And here's where we get to a fascinating story. Okay, up until 100 years ago, we had sources from this time period, but not so much. And then we have this incredible discovery, one of the great discoveries of all time, okay? In 1896, there are two scholarly Christian sisters from England, Agnes Lewis and Margaret Gibson, and they traveled all over the world, and they traveled to Egypt. And they had heard that in Egypt, in the synagogue in Cairo, in the Ibn Ezra synagogue in Cairo, the Ben Ezra synagogue in Cairo, they heard that there was an attic with documents. Now, they were Christian women, but they knew a lot, and they knew what a geniza was. Geniza, for those who don't know what it is a place where you put sacred texts that are in such bad shape that you can't use them anymore, right? Most shuls have a geniza. If you walk around in Jerusalem, there's actually in some neighborhoods genizas on the street where you can put in your old sidurim or your old chumashim. But this synagogue had an attic with a geniza, and they managed to get entry to it. And what they saw is that this was masses upon masses upon masses of fragments of texts. And they were so excited by it. They go back home and they go to their friend, who happened to be a rabbi and a scholar, and his name is Solomon Schechter. And they go to Solomon Schechter and they tell him about this. And of course, he comes, and eventually they are able to raise money and to bring a large part of this geniza to England, where it was studied. Solomon Schechter's description is the best description I've read of this. It is a battlefield of books, and the literary production of many centuries had their share in the battle, and their disjecta membra are now strewn over its area. So as you can understand from his quote here, these are many, many fragments, 400,000 fragments. Now, out of this incredible mess, scholars have been sifting for the last 100 plus years and finding incredible things. Now, one of the fascinating things about the Cairo Geniza is that the community was very strict, and they didn't only put in the Geniza an old Siddur, an old Sefer Torah, anything that had Hebrew, that had God's name, that had a reference to anything religious, even something that had, like, you know, on the top, Bezrat Hashem, they put that in the Geniza. So that included contracts and letters and kitubot, right? Marriage contracts, besides all the holy books. So you have this incredible treasure trove, just a lot of it from this time period. Okay, so we have everything ranging from the original Hebrew texts of books that we had only in translation, okay, to many, many poems, Piyutim, that we're going to talk about in a little bit, plus lots of business documents. Scholars have been picking this apart and finding so much for decades upon decades, and it illuminates our period as well. So that brings us to one of the great works of Tveria, of the Jews of Tveria, from the 6th century and on, and that's Piyut. Okay, what is Piyut? Piyut literally means a song, right? A poem. It begins in Byzantine land of Israel, 4th century, 5th century, what's called the classical period of Piyut, because Piyut is still being written today, okay? But the classical period is the 6th to the 8th century, right? A little bit before the Muslim period, during the Muslim period. A lot of it written in Tveria, a lot of it lost and now found in the Geniza. What's the concept here? Okay, we know the Sidur as a fixed book, that you go and you say the same thing. And on Shabbat, every Shabbat, you say the same thing that you said last Shabbat. Piyut tries to create variety, right? Tries to take the concept. The rabbis are torn between having prayer that is fixed and prayer that is spontaneous and innovative. And Piyut tries to bridge that gap. So what you'll have is you'll have different prayers for different occasions. So I brought you a few possibilities on the right here. There's a picture of the beautiful synagogue in the Golan, Umma Kanatir, just to illustrate, you know, a synagogue from this time period where they may have said Piyutim. So you have things that are called krovot, right? This is special songs that you would add to the repetition of the Amida of the Shmoneh Esrei on Shabbat in the morning. Shivatot, what you would add to Musaf. Kinot, we know Kinot, right, from Tisha B'Av. Songs, prayers of mourning. Now, some of us see this in the Siddur today, and we're like, oh, skip, right? But you have to appreciate the desire to innovate. And you have Paitanim who will write a poem for each parasha, for each week, so that every Shabbat, we're going to see one in a minute, you read something different, right? You have Paitanim who are going to write different poems for the holidays, right? They're going to use a lot of allusions to biblical text, to midrashim. Often they're going to write, and some of us remember this from the keynote, they're going to write in acrostic form, in alphabetical, right? Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Sometimes they'll add their names at the end in the acrostic. Okay, so you have this beautiful desire to be creative and innovative in tefillah. So I brought you one. It's a little long. We might not do the whole thing, but we might do a little bit. This is one of the Paitanim of our period, right? Of Tveria, Rabbi Pinchos ben Yaakov HaKohen. We know he's from a village near Tveria called Kafra. He writes about it. He writes about the earthquake in 749. So we know he's after the earthquake. Rav Sadia Gaon in the 10th century writes about him. Okay? So we know he's before Rav Sadia Gaon. He's after the earthquake, meaning sometime in the 8th century. We had a few of his piyutim from earlier, but we found the majority of them in the Geniza. Okay? And a lot of times you find them because he signs his name in the acrostic. And this is the piyut that he wrote for the Parshat HaShavua of Vayigash. Vayigash, of course, begins with Judah going before Joseph and begging for the freedom of Benjamin and saying, take me instead. And in the text, Judah goes and he really kind of prostrates himself in front of Joseph and he says, take me instead. And we have our old father at home and he needs to have this young man. But the Midrash goes in a different direction. And the Midrash sets up a dialogue and a conflict between Joseph and Judah, each one kind of brandishing their metaphorical swords. And that's what Rabbi Pinchas HaKohen does here. Okay. And I'll just read it to you a little bit just because the meter and the rhythm is so rich and so beautiful. Ach b'nalechem machartem, b'shitmatchem al damo kamtem, g'di izim b'birma shachatetem, da'agtem levavichem v'sod he'eramtem. This is Yosef's part of the dialogue. You sold your brother for shoes, that's a midrash, okay? You got up from standing over his blood, okay? You shechted a goat to trick your father, okay? You made your father's worried and you kept this secret hidden. And then we have the refrain, Oy lachem midin Chosef, amar lahem Yosef. Woe is you from a revealing judgment, said to them Joseph. And now we have the other side, right? We have Judah. Heach chalila lecha me'asot zot, tamahanu keshamanu mimcha kazot, zekof einecha lamarom ba'al tigale razot, chovotenu garma al kein ba aleinu hasara hazot. Do not do this thing. We are shocked when we hear this from you. Fear God and don't reveal secrets. Our sins have brought this trouble upon us. Bi Adoni b'davracha hamamtanu b'ra'ada amar lahem Yehuda. Please, sir, in your speech you make us shake, said to him Yehuda. And it goes back and forth. And each one kind of accusing the other, begging the other, until you finally have this kind of a surprise ending. Okay. Look at the last paragraph. Chulchalu kishamo milato, zau v'nivlatu v'lo yachalu la'anoto, kol natan v'pchi u'bachu l'matu v'archar kein dibru ito. Joseph forgives them. They don't know what to do. They're very taken aback. And then they speak to each other. So you have this building on the Midrash. You have this this dialogue back and forth. You have rhyme, of course. One of the very beautiful ideas that's going on here is that this is recited out loud in the synagogue. So maybe you didn't pay so much attention to the Parsha. Maybe you don't even know what the Parsha is. But here you have a nice little song, a nice little poem. We read it and we say, wow, the language is so hard, but this is their language. And it's a way to teach Torah in a different way. Right. Instead of the rabbi giving a sermon, you say the piyut. So the piyut was really a way to bring innovation, a way to bring Torah into a different form. Others did not like piyut. Okay. One of the Paitanim who's most famous, we don't know exactly when or where he lived, but his name is Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. We have a lot of his piyutim in the keynote. And he is famously attacked, and we'll read a little bit of what he says, by the Ibn Ezra, by Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who lives after his time, for being so caught up in allusions and riddles and alliteration that you don't have any understanding of what he's saying, right? And one of the most famous examples is this piyut here that he brings for Purim on the left here, which you read it and it's meant to just sound very alliterative. Atz kotzeitz ben kotzeitz kitzutzai lekatzeitz bidibur mefotzeitz ritzutzai leratzeitz letz bebol lotzeitz. You're reading this, you're like, what the heck is going on? But the truth is, he's using this root of ketz and kotzeitz, and he's talking about Haman, right? A kotzeitz, someone who's tearing things down. He's a rasha, the son of a rasha. He's coming to break down the people who are already broken down, right? Once you have the meaning, it's not that hard, but the Ibn Ezra doesn't really like it. And he says, and you sort of gotta, sympathize with him, right? He has a long introduction in one of the psukim in the book of Kohelet, where he really lays into the kalir. The lama lo nilmad mishlomo. Why shouldn't we learn from King Solomon? Shelo haya chacham acharav kamohu. He was the wisest of all men. V'nei tfilato shitpaleo mudat v'kol yodea lashon hakodesh yavinoto. He spoke in a plain, simple language that everybody can understand. V'einenu chidotu mishalim. No riddles, right? And I sympathize a little with Ibn Ezra. And then Ibn Ezra is famous as a grammarian. And he says, the Kalir was not so good at grammar. V'od ki lashon hakodesh biyad Rabbi Elazar. Ir prutza ein chomad, an open city with no walls. She yasemin has charim nekevot, right? He messes up his zachar and his nekevan. He's not careful about grammar. So Rabbi Ibn Ezra doesn't like him. But if you look at other poems, other piyutim of the Kalir, they're much simpler. So for example, one of the famous keynote, which you have here, right? It's all about the different mishmarot kuna, the different groups of priests that move to the north and how they're in mourning because the temple is destroyed, and it's not quite as complicated. So there were pro piyutim people and less pro. Let's talk a little about the Masoretes, right? The Masorah. So up until the Masoretes come along, right? Late 8th, early 9th century, everybody knows the Nikud, right? Everybody knows how to say the words, how to read them, what the tune is. And that's why if you look at a Sefer Torah, which is what I brought you here, and as most people know, a Sefer Torah does not have Nikud, and it does not have Ta'amim. It doesn't have the vowelization. It doesn't have the notes. It doesn't have the annotation. And anybody who learns to lane has to learn that stuff by heart, right? You have to read it from the Torah, but you don't have those nice little helping hands. But the Masoretes in the 8th century, we don't know what was necessarily the catalyst for it. Perhaps they felt that just the diaspora was so dispersed and people weren't getting the knowledge that they needed, but they decided it needed to be written down. And this was revolutionary, just like writing down the oral law was revolutionary. And they made up a system of vowels. They made up a system of notes that we still use today. And that's why I brought you on the right here, just a little page from a Chumash, right? Which has all the Nikudot, which has all the Ta'amim. And we still use it today. And anybody who's a bar mitzvah boy or a bat mitzvah girl learning their Parsha, they can't survive without this. So they are very thankful to the Masoretes. The teachers in Tveria, the grammarians and the linguists in Tveria were famous throughout the Jewish diaspora. And we have references that talk about them going to teach in various places because they were considered to be the experts. And the most famous family that did this was the Bar Asher family. And in fact, they are partly responsible for the most famous codex, right? The most famous, not a Torah scroll, but a book of Torah that's written in Tveria. And that, of course, is the Aleppo Codex, or as it's known in Hebrew, the Keter Aram Tzova. Now, the Keter has a fascinating story to it. Someone, perhaps a Karaite family, we don't know, commissions a scribe in Tiberias to write them an authoritative Tanakh, right? Not a Torah scroll, but the entire, you know, 24 books. It is gone over and checked by the most famous of the Masoretes, and that's Aaron ben Asher. Okay, this is happening in the early 10th century, probably about 920. Okay, eventually, it's brought to Jerusalem to Karaites who are there. When the Crusaders conquer Jerusalem, they steal this book, because not only did they ransom people, they ransomed books because they knew the Jews would pay for books. And they put this book up to be ransomed. The Jewish community in Egypt, right, in Fostat, paid to redeem this book and to bring it to Egypt, where it is used by none other than Maimonides, right, who says he wrote his own Sefer Torah. He's writing the laws of writing a Torah scroll. And he says, the copy on which I relied is the well-known Egyptian codex, which contains the 24 books of the scriptures, which have been in Jerusalem for several years, used as the standard text for the examination of scrolls. Everyone relied upon it because it had been examined by Ben Asher, who closely studied it for many years and examined it again whenever it was being copied. This codex was the text on which I relied, says Maimonides, in the scroll of the law that I wrote according to the rules. Very nice. It's in Egypt. Where does it end up? In Aleppo, in Aram Tzova. So somehow, and we really don't know how, there's a lot of gaps in the history of the Keter. In the 14th century, it arrives in the Jewish community of Aleppo. It's brought to the Great Synagogue, which is the picture that you have over here on the left. Unlike Maimonides and scholars before him, the Jewish community of Aleppo does not use the codex. I mean, they use it, but in a very different way. They put it basically in a safe in the basement, and they see it as a talisman that's going to protect the community and protect the synagogue. And they rarely, rarely take it out and consult it. Only on occasion were scholars allowed to examine it. So, for example, in the middle of the 19th century, a scholar named Kimchi comes and he's allowed to examine it, and he takes notes in a Tanakh that he has, a Tanakh that was only recently rediscovered by someone named Yossi Ofer. In the 40s, Umberto Casuto, that's who you see over here, the famous Bible scholar, Moshe Casuto, is allowed access, and he studies it and writes notes. And that's all very good, because in 1947, the synagogue is attacked after partition, after the UN declares to the state of Israel, making a state of Israel, and the local Arabs are very angry, and the synagogue is attacked. Parts of the codex are destroyed, stolen. If you want to know more about it, there's a fabulous book by the journalist Monty Friedman, who wrote about what happened, or what we think happened, but it mysteriously disappears for 10 years. And in 1958, part of it shows up in Israel, where it's taken into the custody of Yad Ben Tzvi. But there are still pieces of it that are missing or lost, or we don't know. So that's our Keter. A little coming attraction. I will do this next time already, but we're going to talk about the various authorities in Babylonia, in the land of Israel, one of whom is the Resh Galuta, is the Exilarch. Next time, we're going to talk about Rav Sadia Gaon and the Karaites and the different authorities, but I think we will save that for next time and take a look at some questions that we have here or comments. The Rambam we know. Let's see. Husband wasn't in shul on Friday night. Don't know about that. Interesting that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai identifies the graves through practical means, as opposed to the Ari who identified them through Kabbalistic means. Yeah, that is an interesting point. Maybe he thought that the Kabbalistic means wouldn't be accepted by everybody, but that's an interesting idea. All right, dates of the Rambam, we have that. Thank you. Have seismologists made any conjectures on the Richter scale numbers of the quakes? It's a really good question. I have no idea, but it clearly was something very big, right? Because entire cities are destroyed, but I don't know the numbers. What did people speak? What was the vernacular? They spoke Arabic. Right? They spoke Arabic. They spoke Aramaic. Certainly after the Muslim conquest, they're speaking Arabic. But Hebrew. Hebrew is also the language of study. Right? I'm glad you like the piyut. The piyutim and the geniza are vocalized as far as, I mean, I don't think there's one standard, but I think mostly not. But I couldn't tell you all, you know, there's, like we said, 400,000 fragments. Ben Asher and Bar Asher is the same thing. It's just Hebrew or Aramaic. Right. You can see pieces of the codex in the Shrine of the Book. There still is that exhibit there. It's very cool. Was there a rival Masoretic group in Babylonia? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, these are the famous ones. There's a rival yeshiva, two yeshivot, but I don't know about rival Masoretes. Ibn Ezra wrote poetry, of course, right? Ibn Ezra's a grammarian. He's a linguist. And yeah, it's not his style, right? He doesn't like it. It didn't fit into his Peshat approach to life. Very nice. Ibn Ezra is a fascinating character. Maybe we'll do him in a different class. Could I speak more slowly? No, I'm sorry. I can't. And we have links. We have links to all the sources and the timeline. It's all in what Rabbi Kalman put in the beginning. So you can go back. If it was a little too quick, I apologize, but you can go back and take a look at all the sources. And if anybody wants, I made my own translation of the Piyut. It is not a literary, beautiful translation, but it works. So I am happy to send that to Rabbi Kalman to put up as well, if anybody is interested in that. Zoe, thank you. Anybody have other questions, comments?
Thank you. I'm no expert on the Masoretes, but of course there was different, you know, texts of the Torah, which the Rambam used the Ben Asher, but there's the Ben Moshe. I think there were various Masoretic schools that had differing approaches. That's the most famous difference, I think, is in Shiret Hazinu. Is it 70 or 67 lines long? And of course, that's why today we don't have any like Sefer Torah in the world that everybody agrees is kosher. Every single Sefer Torah that exists, some other view holds that in the kosher. I find that kind of you know cool, actually, if I can say that. But yes, there is. It's a fascinating subject we don't spend much time on because they don't teach it in the schools in yeshivot and stuff like that. But yeah, that's the main, what you were talking about, the Ben Asher, that's the Rambam used, the Ben Asher manual, the Aleppo Codex, which, as you say, has gone missing in Matti Friedman's book, et cetera. But thank you very much for that illuminating, as always, lecture. And
just one last question. I see a book on Piyutim. So if you read Hebrew, the expert on Piyut is Shulamit Elitzur. She has collected the Piyutim of Rav Pinchas, and I think she has other books as well. If you want a great, just like a layman's book about the Gniza, there is a book by Adina Hoffman, I believe is her name, Sacred Trash, okay? And it's got a lot about the Gniza. There's other books about the sisters, Agnes and Margaret. You Google around a little bit, but the Gniza is a great story.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Shuli, on behalf of everybody, wish you your mazel tov and look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. For those who were not here at the beginning, Shuli's marrying off a son next week, and she will not be in class this week for good reasons. And next week, so we'll resume this series in 2 weeks. 2 weeks today. So it's a mazel tov. We should have many occasions for all of us to celebrate. Evening, as I mentioned earlier, Shoshana Schachter will be giving the Parshat HaShavuot Shir at 8:30, and then tomorrow I'll be giving the closer look at the Siddur, where I briefly mentioned the Piyut last week, if I can, where, that used to, the davening, correct, lots of variety when you have Piyut, not the same standard form we have in the Siddur. That's tomorrow at 9:30, and then we'll continue with our Shirim next week. Next week we'll have actually two new series are beginning next week, Monday at 11 a.m. and Wednesday at 8 p.m. I'll be sending out an email about that in the next little while. So watch for that, and then all our regular Shirim are continuing, but we're adding two new series next week. Okay, look forward to seeing you soon. Please invite your friends or a friend. If I invite you to invite your friends, that's too hard. So I ask everybody, invite just one person. You're not allowed to invite more than two. Without special permission, you can't invite more than two people to come. But if everybody needs one person to come, they'll be doing great. And we look forward to learning with you. And everybody have a wonderful day. And thank you again, Shuli. And we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. And
okay,
you'll send me
the
timeline, of course, and we'll post with on the website, of course. Okay. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Mazel tov.